Hey there, Pod Squad. This is Catherine Mary saying hello and welcome to another new Smooth Soprano Bits. Just before we start this podcast, I wanted to point out to you that in the interview, I refer cryptically to a performance that I am going to be giving with my interviewee, Vix Hobbs, on Sunday this week. I hope to be able to reveal to you what that performance was about, but iTunes have just informed us today that no podcasts can go up between tomorrow and after Christmas for reasons best known to themselves. Presumably they've got the decorators in, and so I'm having to put this podcast up early, so I can tell you nothing. I will, however, reveal next week what it's all about and where it goes, but I'm sorry to disappoint you will not be finding that out in advance. Thanks again for listening.
Let's pod.
She's talking about the funny things that have her all in fits. She's ranting about the subjects that get right on her tits. She's chatting with the lovely folk and some who are real shits. It's Smooth Style, No Bits. Smooth Style, No Bits. It's a podcast.
Hey all, back here again already. Incredible, doesn't seem 5 minutes since we were together last week. How's things going for you, my darlings? That weather was a bit crazy, wasn't it? Thinking about those poor people that in the theatre in London last night when the ceiling fell in during the show. I was at the theatre last night, in an old theatre which is probably listed, and I was wondering if maybe they've got a wet roof and maybe they're up there checking today. Crazy business. Yeah. I went to my second pantomime last night. Well, I told you I loved them. Last night's was proper. It was had a cast of thousands. It had cheesy pop songs. It had mad jokes. It was lovely in nearly every respect. I'm sorry to carp, but as you know, it's all about smashing the systems at the moment. I was not pleased with the 1970s casting. The cast was entirely white for the first half. This was Robinson Crusoe, by the way. Entirely white throughout the first half. And I was thinking, oh God, really? And then the second half came and Robinson gets to the island. And who does Robinson meet at the island? Well, as we all know in the story Man Friday, this is a sort of slightly bastardized version of the story. And Friday, oh yes, Friday was a gentleman of colour who was wearing a leopard skin loincloth and no shirt. Now, that's not an image that you see very much these days. And I was thinking, okay, well, maybe we're making some kind of island tribal thing. But no, all of the king's, you know, young people, henchmen, were white as well. The only nod towards them being of a different sort of, I don't know, race or a nationality or something was that they suddenly had American accents, which I found was rather odd, but I suppose it was better than some sort of, oh God, you know, fake African-esque sounding voice. The other thing I didn't appreciate was a joke about Sylvanian families that said if you went down to the docks that there were Sylvanian families, were offloading Sylvanian families. And I thought he was making a joke about toys being shipped in, because Southampton is a port, a container port, and lots of toys get shipped in here. But no, he was making a joke about illegal immigrants and then went on to say that they'd all get council houses and benefits. Yes, he went there. So that was a sour moment in otherwise a beautiful, sparkly, as far as I'm concerned, proper pantomime experience. A long way from the Christmas Story with Songs shower that I went to see last week. Anyway, that's two of the three pantomimes I'm seeing this year. I'm going to see Robinson Crusoe again, but only because my brother's in it. In this week's podcast, I'm talking to my lovely guest, Vix Hobbs. I'll introduce her properly in a minute, but in the podcast, we reference my darling dog because he decided to scootle off just before I started talking, and I had to make a decision about whether I was going to cancel the whole thing and go and find the dog or whether I was going to carry on talking. And I made the call, and I carried on with the conversation, and it turned out to be right, as you'll hear. But I thought, yeah, maybe it was time to introduce my the other residents of my home. First of all, is Boaster. He is a big black Labrador, and he is a proper Labrador, meaning that he's a big, stocky dog with a square head. He looks like a friendly dog that you'd meet at the gate of a farm. Some Labradors these days are quite small and pointy. Apparently they were bred smaller because people live in smaller houses these days, and so, you know, people weren't taking on these big Labradors. But I knew Labradors, black Labradors, when I was a child. My granny had a cousin, I don't know what relation that makes her to me, called Jean. And Jean lived in the countryside in two cottages, not together. And Jean smoked and owned racehorses and went salmon fishing. I think she was probably gay. And she had two black Labradors, and oh, I loved them so much. I really did. And then, also related to my granny was the matron of a boys' prep school in Durham, in the northeast of the UK. And the head teachers of the school lived in, and in their flat in the school, they had their big black waggy Labrador, and I loved him too. They also had an elephant's foot stool, which I loved at the time, but now I look back and think, oh my God. But yeah, thick, like toenails and everything. Ugh. Anyway, my darling big black waggy dog came to me 5 years ago, and well, only dog owners seem to understand, but I love the dog. I mean, I don't just like the dog, I love the dog. Like I love my children. I mean, that's just outrageous, isn't it? But we have a cat as well. We used to have two cats, sister cats. Lily for Lily and Chili for the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Chili decided to move out about 2 years ago and went and lived next door, which was all very embarrassing because next door tried to keep giving her back to us for a while, but she wasn't having any of it. So I thought we gave in the end, and Tilly now lives next door and doesn't acknowledge me in the street, which I still feel slightly hurt about. But Lily is still with us. She is what you would call a tuxedo cat. She's a black cat with a white chest and a smooshy white face and some little white paws. And she is a miserable bag. She sits on the side, yowling for food. And then we'll go, oh, I love you, and rub her head against you. And then once you're in there and you're doing the chest fondling, she turns into a slasher and the claws come out. But I quite like her, really, because I feel that there is some part of myself that she represents. All furry and cuddly on the outside, but really inside, I'd quite like to be a Freddy Krueger-style slasher. For the last few years, she has spent living on the sideboard in the kitchen. I gave her a box in the end because it was getting a bit disgusting. But recently, she's moved upstairs, which is very confusing. You're sitting on the loo and suddenly Lily arrives. So, and there you go. I don't know what that's about. I suppose we have to allow for change, don't we? We have to allow people to change. Am I a dog person or a cat person? Oh, impossible to say. I'm both. I read recently something which absolutely knocked on the head for me, that said that, as we all know, that dogs know their owner's voices. Boaster's ears will prick up the minute that I'm anywhere around because he loves me. But it said that cats also know their owner's voices, but they just don't care. You think, yeah, that's kind of it, isn't it, really? They go, all right, it's you. And then just go straight back to sleep again. You gonna give me any biscuits? No? Right. Is it 4 o'clock yet? No. Yeah, 4 o'clock is tea time in our house, and my God, don't you know it. So the Christmas tree is up, I'm delighted to say. I put it up because my daughter celebrates her birthday soon, so it's quite nice to get things up so it looks festive for her. We have a paper tree, which I never thought I would go for. But a few years ago, I experienced our house burnt down. Well, it didn't quite burn down. That makes it sound like a kind of Topsy and Tim story, doesn't it? But it was a very, very serious house fire. Nobody was hurt, but the house was unlivable in 6 months. So we had to move out and live elsewhere while the house was renovated. And of course, amongst the things we lost, amongst the everything that we lost was all the Christmas decorations. So we had to start again. So the first year we did that, we went to a kind of, you know, homewares kind of shop and into their Christmas department just to go look at ornaments, really. And it was actually quite late in the day. It was quite near Christmas Eve, I guess. And suddenly all these sale signs were going up everywhere. You know, now slashed 50%, 20%. And in the middle of the display, where they had a display of a big Christmas tree covered in ornaments, there was a sign that said, "Tree and ornaments, now 20%. And you're thinking, hang on a minute, what? So we went and found the shop assistant and said, could you just explain this deal in more detail? And he said, oh yes, it's a bit knackered, isn't it? Well, if you want it for a tenner, you can have it. So my daughter and I looked at each other and she went, yeah, let's do it. So we bought a fake paper Christmas tree about, I'm just looking over my shoulder, 1, 2, 3, 4, it's about 5-6 foot tall, covered in Christmas ornaments for a tenner. And because it was such a sort of joyful and mad story buying it, I have a great affection for this thing. So when I get it out every year, rather than feeling like a failing parent because I haven't gone out and bought a special, you know, winter spruce full of pain needles to shed all over my floor, we get out our paper tree, we bend down the branches, we get out the ornaments that we bought that day, plus some more that we've bought over the years now. We're building up a collection. And put it up. And it's a joyful thing. It's got that nice kind of higgledy-piggledy, not too matchy-matchy look to it. I'll put up a picture so you can see. So, on to this week's interview. This week I was delighted to spend some time with my friend Vix Hobbs. Vix, well, you'll hear we met. Again, it's music that brought us together. And it's music that has grown our friendship, really. She used to live a little way away, but now lives quite near to me, and is it's really nice to have her as a neighbour and a buddy. We talk a lot about coping, was really the theme of our conversation. Coping with the stresses and strains of life, what it is that we need to keep right, how that's changed over the years, how being single parents has affected us, and how food is such an important part of keeping us, our mental health, on the straight and narrow. So here it is, my conversation with Vix Hobbs. Hello, Vix.
Hello.
Well, this is exciting. We're starting this conversation just as my dog has decided to take himself off for a walk to the common by himself.
Well, it's nice that he does it on his own.
I know. He'll
doesn't hassle you.
We'll get him back in the end. Also, would you mind not putting your cup on here?
Yeah.
Because you're here on the interview that I did with Colin. That there's. So I've learnt my lesson now.
So I'll pop it on the floor. Lovely. Dampened by the carpet.
Hello, Vix Hobbs. Thank you very much for coming to talk to me.
It's very lovely to be
for
here.
For my podcast. So I suppose we should start by saying, how do we know each other? Can you tell the story of how we met?
Well, it's a follow-on from the ukulele jam thing, isn't it? Because of you and Colin getting the jam together, and at a similar time I was getting to know Sarah and Colin. In fact, I'd been to Sarah's 40th at Steeple Lees in Purbeck, and on that very evening Colin was saying to me, oh, you should come to this thing, we've got this first thing, and I think it was that Monday after that weekend or the following Monday after that weekend, and I didn't come for that first one. But then Colin sort of threw his resonator at me and said, come along.
So how do you know them then?
I know them because of your neighbours across the way, Rosie and T.
I never knew that.
And Rosie and T used to, Sarah was their vet. And so they used to talk about Sarah the vet quite a lot. And then we met Sarah the vet one time at their house. And it sort of took off from there.
Because it's so interesting when you actually start exploring these things, like those rock and roll family trees.
Yes.
where you start drawing the lines between the people and what the, yeah, what the roots are that connect with.
And,
because
and
I always
circles
thought,
and circles and circles and circles that suddenly burst into the same sort of circle.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden there's this much larger society that you belong to.
That you're part of without necessarily knowing that you're part of it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
How funny. So you were at social events, literally, I could see you from this house walking along the road to them.
Yes.
And I never knew you. Oh, well, that's interesting, because I thought that you'd met Colin through the ukulele, that you'd come along to the ukulele jam and met Colin that way.
No. No, it was a purely, I hate to use the term random, because I don't think it was random, really, but a series of events from old friendships and lapsed friendships. I think when you find a different group or a group that accommodates and sits with you better, that you kind of leave bits behind. And I don't see Rosie and T very often.
So what was going on in your life at that time? Because you lived in Eastleigh, which is a good sort of, 10-15 minute drive from where we are now then.
What was going on in my life? Oh my goodness.
That you could be, you know, you got in your car and came over to Southampton.
Oh gosh, I mean, I had lots of friends in Southampton. I was very connected to Southampton, but Eastleigh was where I landed when I had my daughter. Both my partner and I were working in Winchester, but we couldn't afford Winchester because nobody can afford Winchester unless you're on the commuter belt, really. And so we bought in Eastleigh, oh my God, 1994, nearly 20 years ago. But a lot of my social life and a lot of my activity was over here. And I played in a folk band where the majority of people were from Southampton. So my connections have always...
So tell me about your life in folk bands, because that was like 10 solid years. What a thing I know about you is that you know your way around Hampshire, incredibly. You know little ways from here to there. And you know lots of little villages and things, which even though I'm Hampshire born and bred and have lived here a massive part of my life, I don't... No, to the same extent as you do. And I've often thought that must have been about playing in pubs in places and...
I think that's my love of real ale, actually.
Ooh.
More than the band, because the band I was in, Skimmington Ride, had a regular slot at the Tudor Rose in Romsey. They used to play every Sunday night, that ale. Then it went to every other Sunday. And then when I started doing my degree, it went to once a month. But we would pack out the Tudor Rose on a Sunday night, and it was just a rollicking,
just
good
a big party
gig,
every Sunday.
And I did that for 9 years, and that stopped in 2007.
The band stopped.
We were sort of displaced from the Tudor Rose, and in fact, the Beggars Fair kind of steps out of Skimmington Ride and numerous other things in Romsey. So
we
were kind of
folk festival that goes on in Romsey now.
Yeah. My knowledge of Hampshire is predominantly to do with pubs.
And going out to find a good beer.
Finding a nice beer.
Oh,
And also walks.
Yeah.
Just walking. I love walking, so I will go off and find places to trundle.
To trundle, Vixen, her regular trundles.
Mm, not so regular this year, oddly enough. But
so you talked about doing a degree. Tell me about that.
I did my degree in 2002 to 2005, so I was a late comer to university education, having left school with nothing.
Yeah.
School was... my head wasn't in the right place.
And what has your working life been about?
I was an administrator for 12 years. Worked in all sorts of places, and in between jobs, because I'm sure that you know that as a single parent, part-time posts can be downsized and upsized around you, and you are quite expendable. So I had a fairly busy process of moving to different places to work, and had to work because I was on my own. I also did some chambermaiding work, and I was a life model for a while, and I did some picture framing work. I was a cleaner. I did whatever.
Yeah,
I turned my hand. I'm a working person.
Yeah.
I find it really boring not working. So I was an administrator, and then I was administrating at Solent, and I just suddenly went, do you know what? I don't want to be on this side of the process. I want to be on the other side of the process in terms of learning and potentially going into teaching.
And what was your degree that you did?
I did a degree in theatre arts education and deaf studies.
Now, why? Because that's a big old statement of, you know, of purpose and intention. It's not a sort of,
yeah.
I'm not going to just do an English degree or a history degree. It's very, it's like being, a, you know, I'm going to be a doctor.
Yeah.
I'm doing theatre studies with deaf.
There were two things I knew for sure. I had done theatre when I was younger, and in fact I wanted to be an actress, that's what I wanted to do. And I'd done theatre when I was younger. Alistair Black, the then drama chap, had said to me, well, the best way to get into drama and into acting is to work hard at school, which instantly turned me off, and I started singing in bands instead.
Yeah.
And kind of ditched the theatre aspect of my life. And I also knew that education was something that I was quite switched on by in so many respects, including being switched off from it, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, so you've got it's a sort of strong reaction. You reacted against one sort of education, but...
Yes, I mean, I wanted to learn, but I wasn't ready to be formal within that. I learnt in other ways.
Special life ways.
Life ways, yeah. And so I knew that theatre was one of those, I knew that education was one of those, and I did, as part of my work, I did a deaf awareness course and was watching and learning some parts of sign language and just loved it. I just thought, gosh, that's beautiful. I'd love to learn to do that.
Mm.
And I gave myself a catchment area and wondered, was it linguistics? I just didn't know what it was. Gave myself a catchment area, and Reading was right on the cusp of that. And there was this course,
right.
Theatre Arts, Education and Deaf Studies. And it was this beautiful marriage and a unique course.
I'd imagine it's an unusual course, is it?
It's unique. The closest you'll get to it is in America.
Yeah.
It was a phenomenal thing to do and a wonderful thing to do, and I'm enormously proud.
Yeah.
And then went on to teach for 5 years on the same course.
Do you have a sense of how long had the course been running by the time? Has it been there a long time?
It had its 25th anniversary 2 years
ago.
It's
a long-standing thing.
Last year. But it started off just as a one-year certificate, and it was specifically for deaf practitioners wanting to use drama within their teaching, and also lots of people know this history better, but there was a theatre for the deaf, which is distinctly different from deaf theatre, which is not accessible to hearing people.
Right,
but this was about an integration of deaf and hearing people, and ideally all the people within that continuum of deafness, because you can be hard of hearing or have slight partial hearing loss or what have you. And so it started as a one-year certificate and flourished, and eventually they pushed for it to be an undergraduate degree, and initially they just had 1 year running all the way through, and then they began to have concurrent years, and it's an amazing course, and a lot of students, just that the marriage of those three things seems to really fire them up.
And are there deaf and hearing students on the course?
Deaf and hearing students, yes, and also deaf and hearing lecturers.
Amazing.
So
you just absolutely fell into this thing which was tailor-made for your... Did you sort of get there and flourish, or was there a period of, what have I done, is this...
I was hungry. I was really hungry for it. I wanted to learn. Yeah. I wanted to do a degree. I wanted to stop developing my backside and my insecurities, which was what admin felt like it was doing for me. And also Mads had started school, and I just thought, well, actually, there's going to be a point where Mads is going to leave me, and she isn't my sole focus, and who and what will I be when she goes? And also a sense of self, which I think is quite important to hand on to your children. If you are distinct in your own right, then your child has license to develop their own points of distinction, good or bad. I'm not going to dictate that.
Oh, I so think that. I can't remember precisely why, but that thought keeps popping up a lot recently. Like, how do we get children to do this? How do we get... You think, well, by doing it yourself.
Yes.
You know, you model... you want children to read books. Well, read.
Yes.
You know, so reading is a normal thing that we do in this house, and that's... How do I get my children to eat vegetables? Yes. Well, eat vegetables.
Eat vegetables,
and then you know, yeah. they'll get there.
That was a big rule in our house, was that, I mean, that was the one thing that we did. I may have been going up and down to Reading and life may have been manic, but I made damn sure that every evening we sat down and had a meal together.
Yeah.
And chatted and caught up with each yeah. other and found out what yeah. day was like, or just had a moment to just commune with each yeah. other before she went off to
yeah,
a bedroom
and sit
or
at a table and just be together in this space, not just passing.
Yeah.
yeah. So
and that felt really important. I remember you when we had our rehearsal last week. We were rehearsing last week.
Talking about the
McDonald's thing about trying to get Grace to go to McDonald's because it's just I can't be bothered, let's do this, and the fact that actually we've trained our children fairly well yeah. to be utterly repulsed
yeah.
by that.
Grace is deeply shocked yeah. if I ever, like literally once a year, I can remember doing it, driving back from somewhere and it was late and I saw a McDonald's drive through on the side of the motorway.
Yeah.
And I just sort of went and she was looking at me like, really? Yeah. We're going in? Really?
What are you doing, Mother?
What are you doing? Have you lost your mind?
Yeah.
Can't believe it. What are you having? Also, I don't know how to do it. I don't know the words for ordering in places like that. Do you know what I mean? People will say, oh, I want a triple doodah burger with extra this and that. I think, I just want some food. Could I have some, please?
A triple doodah burger. I'd be interested to know what that would be like and what's in it.
The doodah shop.
The doodah.
Maybe
burger.
That's a business idea for the future.
Who knows? Who knows?
So we have our single parenthood in common.
Yeah.
Don't we?
Yes. And music. Single parenthood and music.
And I thought, when I was thinking about what I'd like to talk to you about, was the idea of the things that we do to cope in life. Coping is a bit of a negative word, isn't it? But my God, sometimes coping is... I don't know about you, sometimes coping is all there is. It's like just getting by, getting through it. And sometimes I get to a place where I'm in such a... There's a bit before coping where I just end up in a bit of a black hole and I can't do anything. But yeah. then when I come out of it, what are the things... What I universally do is remember, oh yes, this is what I do. I remember.
Okay, yeah.
I don't stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? And I suddenly remember what the coping things are.
Yes.
And they're so easy to lose. Do you find that? Are you very good at...
Yeah, I think I'm in a process of change at the moment, so I'm wondering exactly what my coping strategies are. I think because so much has changed, having finished lecturing and trying to forge forward in a sort of self-employed freelance right at swapping hats all the time and things. I haven't worked out exactly what the strategies are yet because I don't know what the issues are quite.
Yes.
But I can remember, I think this was roughly around about the same time I decided to do a degree, that I did a sheet of when things get messy. That was the title.
Yeah.
And it's in my, what would probably be termed deeply uncomfortably as my self-development folder.
Yes.
With an article from here or there or one of those sheets that my mother gave me with counselling stuff on it and what have you. And the list was, the checklist for me was, yeah. are you tired? Are you hungry? Are you hormonal?
Oh, yes.
And if it was all three, oh shit.
Yes.
And I think the one underneath that, the bottom one was, just remember, nothing is funny.
Right.
Nothing is funny. Nothing Everything is, funny. Is deadly serious. And as soon as I read that,
you
I
think,
just,
oh, for God's sake.
I think just the fact that I actually sat there and wrote it, you know, that particular thing, it's just like,
what
oh,
was
okay.
it? Tired, are you?
Tired, hungry, hormonal.
Tired, hungry, hormonal. I read a very good thing, which was, it's not those, but it's like that. It's H-A-L-T. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Those were the four.
Oh.
And it's halt. So it's like, stop.
Okay.
Ask yourself these questions.
Okay.
Are you hungry?
Yeah. You see, hungry makes me angry.
Oh, for God's sake.
Angry
completely.
Or miserable. My
yeah,
blood,
yes.
I think it's blood sugar.
Yeah,
thing,
yeah,
so
yeah.
I just
completely.
Drop. And I
have
just
you had
go,
that with your children as well? You're trying to have a conversation with them. And you go, have you had any breakfast? No.
Yeah.
And you think, right, eat this banana. I'll come back in 20 minutes and we'll start this conversation again about your room, or the, have you done any washing or whatever it is.
And it's actually phenomenally easy because we're physiological beings.
Exactly.
With the burden of being able to think. Actually, you know, if you go through the physical process of saying, well, what does my body need here? Yeah. And actually, I clocked a couple of years ago when we were going through some stuff with Mads, that actually the brain requires a phenomenal amount of calories to work properly.
Yes, yes.
And so that if you're not feeding it, it kind of, it's like a machine where the mechanisms stop working particularly well. And actually, that's such a vital thing.
And you're trying to use your brain to get out of this situation that is fundamentally, your brain is the cause, is the problem.
Yes, and so those things, you know, nourishment is not just about feeding your body, but also feeding the mechanics of your mind that enables you to get through the everyday, which on one day is easy and the next day is just impossible.
Yeah. I've been doing a thing recently where I was very dissatisfied with what I was eating. I was finding I was eating a lot because I was bored, and just doing it as a sort of just a default thing.
Yeah.
Oh, what shall I do now? Oh, well, I'll eat while I'm sort of moving on to the next thing.
Mm.
And so I decided that I wouldn't eat. I said, right, I'll just sort of fast consciously until I feel hungry. So I'll sort of try and bottom out. And then I can start again. Yeah. I didn't get hungry for about a day and a half.
Yeah.
And that was really quite sort of shocking.
Yes.
That I could just sort of carry on. And that's not a, you know, that's not a thing to do for a long period of time. But it was quite sort of interesting. Also, I take medication at the moment, which does weird things to me. And I think it does strange things to my appetite as well. Because I've been doing this for about 2 weeks now. And I still don't have particular feelings of hunger.
No.
But I do get aware of feelings like panicky or...
Or a slump.
Or a slump. Or just getting... Suddenly the children are really annoying or the dog's annoying or something.
Yeah.
And it's like pain relief, isn't it? I mean, it's a stupid comparison, but I don't know if you've ever spent any time in hospital, but I remember a nurse saying to me, don't wait till it hurts before you take the next... You know, yes. 4 hours, take the drug.
Yes.
Because the point is to not become in pain.
Yeah.
Not to allow yourself to be in pain, then take the pain relief, come down. So the point is to try and... It's such a simple...
I think I hit burnout. It was when I was at Solent, actually. I hit a real...
This was at university?
Yeah, when I was
admin.
Yeah. And I hit burnout for one reason or another, and I'm not being evasive on that. I cannot remember why.
Yeah.
It was just, I think just things just got too much and I burnt myself out. And I can remember being prescribed antidepressants, and I took them for a day and a half and felt twice as bad as I had before. And I threw them out aggressively and went, right, yoga, St. John's wort, what's going on with my food and my eating?
Yeah.
And for about 5 or 6 months after that, religiously, without fail, I would stop mid-morning and have a Nutri-Grain bar. And I would stop mid-afternoon and have an apple. And I would just...
Like medicine, like you're taking a pill.
It is a
pill.
Kind of dosing yourself to keep you level rather than having those big drops. And I don't think I ever really experienced big highs, but certainly the drops and the slumps.
It's amazing, isn't it, that it's something that... I mean, here we are... You know, grown women that are still sort of learning and grappling with these ideas and coming. And it's why isn't this something that is just there, just as a given in life? It's so funny that food has ended up in this very strange world where we just sort of eat all the time and there's all this sort of crap available which is not sustaining in any way.
Yeah.
In fact, it's unsustainable.
Yes.
For all sorts of reasons.
But it's interesting that you talked about boredom as well, because I think who is it? It's Alan Rickman. The lovely Colonel Brandon in Sense and Sensibility.
All right.
And he's standing outside that door with Kate Winslet all sweaty and pale and grey and looking awful. And his phrase is, give me an occupation lest I go mad.
Mm. And I've heard you say that.
That rings so true to me that when I... Oh, it's come full circle. So that when I'm not doing something, or when I haven't got a focus, or when I don't have a drive towards something, my brain eats itself. Mm. It doesn't matter what I'm eating around that, from a physiological point of view, but my brain just does itself in because I'm not striving, I'm not occupied, I'm not pushing myself towards something.
What's your brain telling you? Is your brain telling you,
oh, do you really want to go there?
What is it that the world...
what time is this going out?
Everybody's going to die, or that you're a piece of shit, or...
Oh, my goodness. I think I can get quite obsessed and hung up on particular things. I've got a wonderfully speculative brain, which I'm sure at some point will be enormously useful.
Just heard my dog. I think the dog's back, so I'm just going to go and...
Okay. Ribbed me mercilessly when I was little. So my sense of anger, or my notion about anger is that it's something to take the piss out of. That angry Vicky is comical and hilarious.
Right.
And so what I have done is swallowed it for years.
Oh, and it's only a joke. Don't be so serious.
Yeah. Or if I got angry about something, I would... I mean, I can imagine that... In fact, I know that me angry can be quite funny.
Oh, like anybody angry. Like a small child being angry.
Yeah, you do the whirlwind tornado thing and you go... Wah! And I'm sure it is hilarious, but at the time, I really didn't need my emotions to be battered like that. And so anger doesn't sit with me particularly
well. And where are you
well.
And your sister in...
We're opposite ends, 11 years apart.
Gosh, so you probably, I mean, you didn't have much of a, you weren't, you know, close siblings when you were little. How's your relationship grown as you're older?
I think we come in and out of closeness.
Yeah.
She has two children. I've got a frantic life. I mean, she has a frantic life with her two children as well. But I think that, I mean, she went to boarding school when I was little. So she wasn't really around very much. So in my head, I almost feel like I had two brothers and I wasn't really aware of my sister, apart from holidays.
Yes, I'm a bit like that with my older brother who is...
She came back in the holidays and that was it, really.
And then she was just glamorous and older and...
Yeah, she was the beautiful one. I was the clown. You know, she was the lovely one.
Did your brothers go to boarding school?
No, they didn't actually. Mm-hmm. No.
Why did she go then? Was she clever? Or?
I think it's what Mum and Dad wanted and felt was right. She went to Christ Hospital.
Oh, wore that cool outfit.
Yeah.
Crazy outfit.
Yeah.
They were.
I think they felt that was what they wanted to do with her. Tim was a different deal. And then life just changed just completely because Dad died when I was 10. So schooling and the way we had lived, which was in vicarages and things, that completely changed. And Mum had to get a house and get a mortgage.
So was your dad a parish priest? He was a...
Yes.
That sort of vicar?
Yeah, absolutely. The first parish I remember was Eastleigh. You know, the burnt-out church on the roundabout that is now key worker
houses.
So
there is that connection right there?
Yes. So he was the vicar there, and then he became ill, and we moved to Ampfield. And he was vicar there up until he died.
Yeah.
So vicarage life
was he ill for a long time before he died? Was
4 years.
Was Dad being ill just a sort of feature of life as a child? Were you aware of it?
Yes and no. I think more I remember, I mean, Dad was quite a reflective person, a very thoughtful person. Spent a lot of time in his study. Which is still in my head.
Vicars do somehow. There's vicars and their studies.
Vestries and studies and things like that.
I have a grandfather.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Now, this is where we connect as well with church and music and things.
Yeah.
And singing. So I don't really remember him being ill per se, apart from very close to when he died.
Yeah.
But he was a very thoughtful, contemplative person and would have his space with his binoculars and his bird watching books and his pipe and his desk.
His pipe and his desk.
Yeah,
I'm imagining
a sort
of Miss Marple-y kind of vicar now.
Oh, really?
Let you
live.
He
used to like
Bob
Dylan and the Stranglers and things like that.
Yeah, I have to remember. We're not in 1930s rural.
No. We're in the 70s. So, you know. So, but no great memory of that, really.
And how was it when he died? How did the adults around look after you in the middle of
back
all that?
Back to coping again, aren't we?
Back to coping, yeah.
Back to coping. Mum was very strong, very solid. She lost her mother in the same year.
Oh, good God.
And Grandma's demise seemed to disappear. It wasn't, didn't seem to be a focus, because mum and dad never owned a house, so it was the first time that she had to go and get a mortgage and house us all and start to be the breadwinner with a little bit of diocese help. So there was a pension and such like. But there was a lot of rallying around, an awful lot of rallying around, and the kind of the vicarage network was there, which is why I have a huge sense of community, and why community is important to me. I can't do the insular, this is my house and these are my things and here I am. Those relating to and communing with other people is really important for me, and I know that that comes directly from that vicarage upbringing and from congregational get-togethers and things like that. It's just part and parcel for me. I don't necessarily like big crowds of people, but I have a sensibility about people coming together, which quite often reduces me to tears. So, but I seem to remember that we all sort of took in a deep breath and got on with it. You do. What else do you do?
Yes. I suppose. What happened at school?
School?
Did you have some days off school?
Actually, oddly,
did school say
right at that point in time. I think my father died on the Monday. I didn't go to school on the Tuesday. I went back to school on the Wednesday and had a long, long chat with my headmaster, who had been a verger at my father's church and loved my father dearly. So he took me into his office and we had a long conversation about Dad, which was really lovely. And there were a lot of people who didn't think I should be back at school. They thought it was too soon. But what was I going to do at home, kind of thing, you know? And something needed to be normal. And school was somewhere that it could kind of be normal. And it was the beginning of the Easter holidays. And so Easter was sort of there and school was shutting down. And then it was time to sort of get on with funerals and get on with what the hell we were going to do next.
People in and out of the house and cleaning up stuff.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there was a process of going and looking at houses and...
Do you remember crying?
Stuff.
I mean, you talk about it. I mean, you're talking about it now.
Yeah.
As if you're you were the parent in this situation. That you were.
Yeah.
You talk about it in a very not. I don't mean dispassionate, but I mean I had to carry on and look after the children.
Yes, I did cry, but I think when you're that age, things are much more black and white.
Mm-hmm.
I think had I been Tim or Emmy's age, I know I would have had a very different experience. But it is what it is.
Yeah.
And I think children tend not to load it up with any more than what it is. I think down the line the repercussions are different.
Yeah.
But at that very point in time, I can remember crying in church at the funeral, and I remember crying when I was first told, and lots of statements of it's not fair, and it didn't feel fair. But what it did for me, and still to this day does, and quite often it pisses me off that experience comes up as this really seminal thing, and it can't be anything but.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sort of plague me or anything. But I know that my sense of permanence and that sense of your parent or your parents being invincible and always there to keep you safe disappeared very rapidly.
Right.
It was gone. It was that bubble was burst completely. And so my sense of permanence and my sense of safety, which I think is crucial for a child, was gone.
Yeah.
And Mum was very solid and kept the house together and all the rest of it. But that ideal that as a child that there's this hub and this place that keeps you safe was burst.
Just gone.
It was burst.
And so do you link your, because I think you, I mean, you've talked about how you, you know, you weren't particularly engaged in school and you scooted around and then went off and, as far as I can tell from the way you've talked about it, lived this kind of, I don't know, like when you and Maz's dad were together and this life of, you talked about just sort of smoking drugs and living in houses and scooting around. It just sounds like a sort of, like you're in, oh God, you know, what's the Uncle Monty thing?
With Nell and I.
Yes. In this sort of With Nell and I-ish.
I'm not sure that it was quite as decadent as With Nell and I.
A sort of happy With Nell and I. I don't know, that's the sort of image I have of it.
Yeah. I think
do you think you would have done that anyway? Or did that sort of...
God, that's a million-dollar question, isn't
hopping
it?
Hopping about...
It's so difficult to...
Not go to university.
Project on the null hypothesis in that. Because I think it's a game of two halves, because there's obviously that experience. There's also being the youngest of four, and as I said, sort of being a sponge for everybody else's tastes and likes and attitudes. And I think that there is a struggle as a youngest to determine yourself and your likes and your wants in the face of all those things you've sponged up. And so I think there is a sense of rebellion and a sense of ricocheting. Right off the scale to something else. Yeah, absolutely. And oddly enough, and I'm going to use the word Renaissance because it came up this week, didn't it? Is that I feel now, particularly having kind of done the university thing and being so attached to Reading University and doing and teaching there as well as having done my degree, and having said actually I don't want to play in that arena anymore. It's not an arena that's working for me. Is that there's this sort of renaissance of a rebellion happening again for me, which was another part of what I was thinking about this morning when I was wondering what you were going to challenge me, talk to me about. I feel a little bit more willing to speak up and out and be angry. And be motivated to say that's not what I want the contents of my life to be, or that's not how I want the space that I'm in to function, or that actually I can see that as fundamentally not working, particularly in terms of society, and specifically particularly after this week in terms of Southampton, the place where I live. I don't want it to be a complacent space that can't move and can't breathe, or cannot welcome and attempt something other than what it's always done and always been. I'm not a person with change for change's sake, but I certainly think that if there need to be changes, then people should be open to considering how they might do that or what that might contain, with less of an attachment to what we already understand, because I think there's so much more for all of us to understand and to appreciate and do and try and support each other in those endeavours, kind of thing. And that's where I'm at right now.
Feeling a bit angry.
A little bit, yeah.
I'm personally smashing patriarchy at the moment. Extremely angry about patriarchy.
Okay.
I'm just furious about it all the time.
Yeah.
And I just want to keep rubbing people's noses in it. And when they go, my drain is blocked, I would go, well, that's because of the fucking patriarchy. Everything.
Okay.
Patriarchy at the moment.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and
yeah, no, I hear that.
And so I'm working on smashing that at the moment.
Okay.
I'm not, you know, not in any very organised way. I haven't got a spreadsheet, you know, with an action plan on it. But
I think if you had a spreadsheet with an action plan on it, you'd be paying right into the patriarchy anyway, wouldn't you?
What a good point.
Got it, sister. Chaos. Absolutely.
Got to love a bit of chaos.
I mean, I don't. I've never really considered myself to be a particularly political beast. I can remember having a campaign for Nicaraguan Solidarity poster when I was 15.
Yeah.
And I did have a CLD poster. It was a beautiful poster. Yeah. Actually, it was lovely. Lovely, yeah. Sort of folksy.
Yeah.
Folksy stuff. Like American art, sexy kind of thing. Yeah. But I've never really felt like a political beast. And I don't know whether that's something that occurs either in your 40s or whatever, but certainly it appears to be occurring now that I am more interested, less tolerant. I listen to, you know, sort of Prime Minister's Question Time or sessions in Parliament, and I get so angry with the fact that they sound like a bunch of kids just rowing with each other and calling each other names. And actually, I can't see any reason why anybody who thinks that that's a good way to behave should be running the fucking country. I'm sorry, but that's running a country has to be surely a more adult pursuit and a more mindful pursuit. And I can't see, it feels mindless and childish and boisterous.
With the emphasis on the boy.
I think it is the emphasis on the boy. I mean, most of the female politicians that I've seen, it feels like they never heard.
Yeah, I know.
Not really.
I can't imagine what it's like to go into that, into work in that building. I watched a debate from the Scottish Parliament recently, which was because I've been following the No More Page 3 campaign, which is campaigning to get the Sun to stop
printing. Caroline Lucas has been on that
page
one,
3.
Yeah.
And one of the Scottish MPs had got a debate about it, so I was watching it. And they're all working in this modern building.
Mm.
And you think, my God, it looks so different. It's incredible, the difference in tone and standard of debate and everything, because they're working in this space rather than working in this confrontation. I mean, for example, it's a circular space like the European Parliament is or the United Nations is. Mm. This idea of a sort of, a sort of collegiate sense of we are here working together, not that we are working against each other. I am shouting at you. No, I am shouting at you.
Yes. And it doesn't smell of mothballs.
It's a shame that, you know, a few more little bombs didn't fall on the House of Parliament in the war, and then we might have a different building and how different it might all
look. Yes, and how, well, I mean, had Guy Fawkes actually been successful?
Good, I'm very close to Guy Fawkes in my heart because that's my birthday.
Of course, November. Yes.
Yeah. So, and one of the gunpowder plotters is called Christopher Wright, which is the name of my brother.
Oh, there you go.
Yes.
There you go.
So I've always felt very close.
Don't feel sort of reincarnate
to Mr. Fawkes, that I should go and blow it up. Well, of course, he was a very small cog in the massive plot, but I won't do a whole lecture about it once.
Small cog, not the grease.
No.
Sorry, reference
no,
there.
Not the grease.
Let's keep him out of this.
Hungry. So what were yours? Yours were, am I hungry?
Tired.
Am I tired?
Hungry, hormonal.
Hormonal. So have you always been, no, you said this hungry, angry, hormonal thing. When did you write your sheet, your When Life Gets Messy sheet?
I think that was when I hit burnout.
Ah, right.
That
so
was when
you
I
were
hit
burnout.
And it was kind of like, okay, you know, well, what...
So have you always had a sense of the sort of hormonal fluctuations in your life?
No, I've actually been quite
conscious
level.
Of it?
I'm quite level. I don't have extremes. They're definitely there, but they're not extreme responses or extreme reactions. Generally, I either get grumpy and painful, or tearful.
Mm. I get clumsy.
Oh, do you?
Oh no!
Oh, that's another thing I've discovered is that don't let me cook or tile when I'm premenstrual.
Oh, right.
Oh,
you'll cook disgusting food, and or your tiling will all be in wobbly lines.
Yeah, I mean, generally I'm a reasonably good cook, and I love food. But I have this moment where.
It's
the things that I have normally put in a pan for years and years. On those particular sessions, you put them in the pan and it's just like, oh, what the hell is that? It's just cooking disaster.
I made the most disgusting pizza recently. Homemade pizza.
Nice.
Easy peasy.
Yeah.
It was disgusting.
Well, what did you put on?
It tasted horrible.
I really want to know what you put on.
It was just the normal things, but it was all sort of burnt and hard, and the dough tasted horrible, and God knows what that was about.
Not on a winner that evening.
We just picked the bits off the top and sort of nibbled them, and I think then Grace had a bowl of cereal to fill herself up.
Does Grace do the polite thing where she goes, no, it's lovely, Mum. No, it's really
Grace is very good. My older child would have said, oh, this is disgusting, and I would have cried.
Yeah.
Whereas Grace, you'll look over and she sort of quietly puts some things on the side of the plate. You know, she's picked out all the... She doesn't like chickpeas, so she'll take the chickpeas out, and put them on the side, and then eat the rest.
Do you infiltrate the cooking with the occasional chickpea just to see whether she's shifted or...
I love chickpeas. I'll cook the chickpeas.
I love chickpeas too. Yeah.
She doesn't like peas either.
Peas.
Peas.
We're not peas.
No, she'll take peas out of a risotto. I think one of you are prepared to put the effort in. Take the peas out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Or eat a pea. And then music. Let us talk about music.
Oh,
because music is such a bloody joy,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
And I think that's how, I mean, for me, that's how our friendship has sort of grown, is
yes.
through the music that we've made together.
Yeah.
What if it hadn't been for the four-stringed wonder? We'd never have met in the first place. And we've been rehearsing a special something.
We have.
Which is now, I'm
which
not
is affording
quite
all
sure.
of us lots and lots of smiles. It's
I'm
just
not sure when
wonderful.
This is going to go out, so I don't think we'll say what it is.
No.
Yet, because we've done very well at keeping the precise nature of our performance secret.
We have.
So that hopefully, I don't know, it might just be a big yawn coming in and going, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
But no, I think people will smile.
I think if we're still loving it, I'm a great believer that, you
know, exactly.
like attracts like. If we're still loving it and we're putting out the energy because we're enjoying it, then I think we'll get it back. Mm. I think we'll get it back.
And
but
I think that's
exciting.
Another thing that I've, you know, when I say learn. Learn is such a big word. Learn has the idea that you've learned it and then you sort of keep it forever, don't you? I learn things and then lose them and then forget them again.
I've learned quite a large number of things over the years.
I have to make music, otherwise I am not right.
Yes.
In the
is
world.
That right with a W?
Ha ha. Yeah. I remember talking to a printmaker
yeah.
who said, I can't explain to you why I do it, but if I don't do it, then I don't feel right.
Then it's wrong, yes.
So
then
I just do it.
Wrong.
So
do.
I don't sort of question it too much. I just make these images and I print them and it gives me a satisfaction and a...
Yeah, I've always had music in my life, either be it church music or I learnt piano and did a lot of singing. I used to do music and singing competitions down at church hall when I was little. And so it's always been part of my life, and obviously singing in choirs and doing iSteadfords at the school I was at and things like that. So
were they called iSteadfords?
They were, yes.
Was there Welshness in your school?
There was Welshness in my school. The headmaster, the same headmaster that had the conversation with me about my father, was Andrew Sanger Davies.
Ah.
And he used to have an iSteadford every year, and you would get awards for French or awards for...
What does the word
work
actually
or...
mean? I'm not sure what the word
iSteadford
means. Does it mean competition, or does it mean...
I've got a feeling it's...
The gathering of the wizards or something.
I think it's festival. It's just a festival,
yeah.
But I'm not...
It's a lovely word, isn't it?
It is iSteadford. That's beautiful. So I did all of that. So music has always been part and parcel of me. And I sing a lot, but I'm quite a shy... I've always described myself as a shy extrovert. But so that's the extreme ends, really, isn't it? And I would love to do more singing. I miss being in a band. I miss gigging regularly. And singing, I think, is my true instrument.
Yeah.
But I find it hard to assert myself. I'm would much rather that somebody found me and threw some songs at me,
right.
or what have you, which is, I think, why we rumble along quite nicely together, because we find things and we both get enthusiastic and
I
go,
quite
yeah,
like
let's
this,
give it a go.
Would that be all right? Yeah, let's just do it.
Yeah. But
you don't have a sort of a repertoire inside you that you're, but oh, if only I could sing show tunes or opera or I don't know, you know,
no,
I think
the sponge
music or
the
something.
Sponge side of me again shakes the ability to define specifically what it is. So and I've also been a great imitator, so I can sing jazz style, and I can get quite operatic.
Yeah,
I can also be quite folky.
So you can sound like a folk singer.
Yeah,
sound like a jazz
singer. So finding
singer,
my
like
own
a...
voice
yeah.
and what that thing is that I do is not always that. It feels like it would be a very hefty road to be on, but I kind of want to be on it. And I have lots of songs that I've started to write, and I've got a verse here or a chorus.
Oh, you know, I was just wondering that,
if
you write songs.
Yeah,
I
think my latest song starts with the opening line of Fuck, I Wish I Had Tourette's.
Ah.
And that's about getting all of those things out of my head and that's the, making that's, a song.
There's a song there. There's the beginning of a. There's definitely the beginning of something there.
Yeah, and I'm sort of it rumbles around in the shower with me and when nobody else is at home because I'm, as I say, I'm quite shy about it.
My something I feel like I have shaken off now, but I was brought up with I think an unhelpful. Musical idea, which was that there was this standard of music. There was a good quality of music and then a rubbish quality. Not that there was good music and bad music, but there was performance that was worth doing, listening to, performing.
Yeah.
And then there was practicing towards that. And so anything that you did that was not playing that as if you were a, you know, virtuoso concert pianist or singing opera like you were Kirita Kalua. Or whatever was almost not. It was a failure. It was a not being good enough. Still to be encouraged because music is a good thing, but you must practice more.
Yes.
Oh yes. What a shame that didn't come out better. You know that sort of.
Oh okay. Yeah.
What a shame about that mistake in the what in, and rather than yay you did it it's wonderful and I've.
It's quite a sort of a kind of jacket to remove.
Yeah.
Once it's on, it's quite hard to remove it. The inner critic, it becomes this inner critical voice, which is ultimately, again, a coping mechanism and somebody there to help, ideally, and identifying why it's there to help. What's it trying to do? And can you negotiate with it?
But I found say, it. Actually, it's my father's voice. And I think probably it's his father's voice coming through him.
Yeah.
You know, because my father was a very, very good pianist. I mean, he was, when he went back to piano lessons after he'd retired, his piano teacher was a concert pianist. You know, he was playing, he had two grand pianos.
Oh,
he was playing
okay.
at that sort of
So there's a standard
level.
Set.
There was
already.
A standard there that he'd never, you know, because he never was a concert pianist but he was always sort of because I suppose he understood that he could be that good so he always had that sense of falling short of that all the time and I had horrible piano lessons as a child. Oh my god.
Oh, we talked about this. Oh, I did the piano lesson thing
and they were full of fear and misery and the room was cold and she had two horrible red setters that would jump and suddenly go ka-ching on the keyboard next to you because they'd be jumping up to get something off the top of the piano. Oh, I hated it. So
that's quite a
and again
a visualization
this, is,
of
this
that one.
Podcast might as well be called the bloody ukulele. I've done at least a couple of interviews where I haven't talked about ukuleles.
Yeah.
But being in this world of these people who, you know, everybody loves the idea of being a kind of rock and roller with this pretend guitar.
Yes. Yeah,
and that playing is enough, you know, really,
yes.
The idea of, you know, learn three chords and suddenly you can be in a band.
Yes, and that actually
is literally
true.
That
you can accompany yourself to sing a song.
Yeah.
And it is as simple as learning three chords.
Oh, and I don't know about you, but I have literally been often moved to tears by listening to somebody in the group play a song on their own or three people will get up and you know that they've been practicing round each other's houses for 6 weeks to perform this little 3 minute song to us all and you know what a joy that is and the and the, you know, the friendship that's involved in that and everything and it's just like
I think you've got
this spark too. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I think Colin said it, didn't he, that, you know, that actually just that moment where you say, oh my god, I'm in a gigging group, and I'd never have perceived that would be something that I could do. And whatever, I mean, I'm a great one for non-elitism and inclusivity, and sometimes inclusivity can rub you up the wrong way, yes, and sometimes you're striving for something more or what have you. But I still think that those experiences are the most profound and the most valuable within that. I'm sure that there are quite a lot of us who would find our way whatever the format.
Yeah.
But what's brilliant about the jam is that there's an opportunity to explore something or just be part of something.
It's very human, isn't
yeah.
it? Very, very
yes,
human.
In positive and negative ways.
it's
just
that great. Ending on the positive, I will say, Vix Hobbs, thank you very, very much for sharing your chocolate and your conversation with me.
Yeah.
And I look forward to singing with you next Sunday.
Sunday.
And if all goes well, I'll certainly tell the story of it after we've done it.
Yes.
Either it'll be a huge triumph or it'll be a disaster, but we'll love it.
Yes. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Brill.
Oh, do we have to?
I like this couch.
Didn't we?
See you same time next week. It's the talking
couch. Well, there you are, beautiful pod people. That was my conversation with Vix. She's great to have a conversation with. She's fantastically articulate and clear in expressing the things she's talking about. But I still have a feeling there's an awful lot more under that bonnet. So at some point in the future, I'm going to get under there with a spanner and have another tinker about. If she'll let me, of course. Maybe I'll just bribe her with chocolate. We were eating Lindt dark chocolate with blueberry bits in it, which I can highly recommend. Next week's podcast, I'm chatting with Catherine Anthony and her daughter, Maisie Anthony Tipper. Catherine is a printmaker and lecturer. She's also an all-round sportswoman, and I'm sure will be running, you know, Iron Woman marathons across the desert before long, if she carries on like that. Then her daughter, Maisie, who's just back from university as we're talking. And we got talking as two old birds and a younger bird about feminism and what it means to us, and what the roots of feminism are for us, where our political ideas came from, and what they're about now, and how they're expressing themselves now. All part of my mission to smash the patriarchy, which I hope you're signing up for. I may issue little badges to anyone who wants to join my Let's Smash the Patriarchy Club. So, the next time I speak to you, it will be after Christmas, so I hope you have a wonderful, peaceful time, whatever you're doing. If you're one of those people that are working through Christmas, particularly if you're going to be working in a hospital or the fire service or the police, thank you. Maybe you love it being away from the madness of it all, but as someone who has had cause to be in hospital over Christmas, I so appreciated the time and love and care that I was shown at that time. So, happy Yuletide, happy solstice tomorrow, deepest, darkest day of the winter. So when I see you, we'll be on the other side, on our way up, back out into the light. So, see you next week.